Hello, this is Steve. Today I will be reading the May 20th through 27th edition of the Washington Examiner. Starting from the editorial page, Biden officials are still lying about immigration. The Democratic Party wants voters to believe the border crisis created by President Joe Biden was an accident that Democrats solved in June 2024 with an executive order tightening asylum screening. This is utterly false. The Biden administration worked hard with the United Nations to facilitate as much migration to the United States as possible. The United Nations reaffirmed the policy this week, and it is therefore only one White House election away from being reinstated by a future Democratic administration. Biden's Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was asked at a security summit this week whether President Donald Trump would have won the 2024 election if Biden had acted sooner to close the border. Quote, "I was very pleased that in June of 2024 we took executive action that, I thought, made reforms that were sensible and proved successful," end quote, Mayorkas responded. Quote, "Our tougher border stance was coupled with an increased focus on providing lawful pathways for people to arrive in the United States outside the hands of smugglers. Those two combined dropped our numbers by 70-75%, end quote. This is a fabrication. In June 2024, the month the executive action was announced, 130,415 migrants were intercepted crossing the southern border. By December 2024, Biden's last full month in office, apprehensions had fallen to 96,000. This is a decline, but of only 25%, not the 75% Mayorkas claims. Southern border apprehensions peaked in December 2023 at 301,981 and fell to 96,000 by December 2024. A 70% decline. But unless Mayorkas is also claiming to have invented time travel, he cannot use a June 2024 executive order to take credit for a decline in border apprehensions that began 6 months earlier. The reality is that the Biden administration, and most particularly Mayorkas and Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, reached a secret deal with Mexico in December 2023, under which they agreed not to announce their immigration executive order until after Mexico's June 2024 election. In exchange, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador agreed to crack down on migrants moving north toward the border. It was Mexico's stepped-up enforcement, not Biden's executive order, that caused border apprehensions to fall. Democrats argue that Biden's new lawful pathways for migrants to enter the country were essential to securing Mexico's cooperation. But Trump has proved that claim false. Trump ended all of Biden's illegal parole programs, and instead of rising, border apprehensions fell to their lowest level ever. Under Trump, zero migrants have been released into the U.S. after being apprehended crossing the southern border for 11 straight months. Before Trump, no president had ever achieved that for even a single month. The Democratic Party and its supranational allies are plotting to reverse Trump's successful immigration policies. The United Nations this week hosted the second International Migration Review Forum to check member countries' progress in implementing the Global Compact for Safe, Orderly and Regular Migration. Like Mayorkas, the Global Compact on Migration seeks to expand regular pathways for migrants, not to help countries keep out migrants if they do not want them. Quote, "Migrant documentation shouldn't be a privilege," end quote, one Global Compact delegate said, aggregating national democratic sovereignty. Quote, "It should be an accessible right," end quote. Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Global Compact on Migration during his first term in office. Biden reversed that policy and rejoined it. that gave billions of taxpayer dollars to the UN High Commission for Refugees to build migrant aid centers throughout Latin America that were expressly designed to help migrants come to the U.S. using Biden's illegal parole programs, what Mayorkas called, quote, lawful pathways, end quote. Biden's parole programs had no basis in statute. They were an illegal abuse of executive power. While Biden was in office, his CBP1 app and CHNV parole programs brought in about 75,000 migrants per month, or about 1 million per year. Since there is no statutory basis for these programs, Democrats could double the numbers unless Congress takes action. The only thing stopping Democrats from colluding with the UN to erase our borders is the Trump administration. In response to the International Migration Review Forum's meeting this week, the Trump administration released a statement called the Global Compact on Migration, an effort to facilitate replacement migration to the United States and our Western allies. Quote, UN agencies systematically facilitated mass migration into America and Europe, even as citizens of those nations called for restrictions on migration, end quote. A statement from the State Department read, quote, UN agencies, working with the NGOs they fund, established a migration corridor through Central America to the U.S. border, end quote. The statement continued, quote, the United States will not legitimize global compacts that enable mass migration into America or Western nations, end quote. The statement concluded, quote, under President Trump, the State Department will facilitate re-migration, not replacement migration, end quote. Asked point blank by Brett Baier in 2022 whether it was the objective of the Biden administration to reduce illegal immigration, Mayorkas said it was not. Quote, it is the objective of the Biden administration to make sure we have safe, legal, and orderly pathways for individuals to be able to access our legal system, end quote, Mayorkas said. The Global Compact on Migration is the kind of international agreement that reminds us how essential the nation-state is to democracy and self-government. Left unchecked, international cities and other international elites and their Democratic Party allies flood communities with millions of migrants from around the world every year. The goal of Democrats is to manage this flow, not to end it. Again, from the editorial page. The Democrats' war on wealth. One congressman making an economically illiterate statement on a comedian's podcast is perhaps not a news story. But Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, is arguably the most visible Democrat on Capitol Hill. In her recent comments about billionaires are part of a broad trend among Democrats and their base to inveigh against wealth creation. As ignorant as their arguments are, it is not merely rhetoric when it influences public opinion, and it becomes what the youngest and most passionate Democrats believe, and they have a destructive policy agenda to back it up. Last week, in response to a question from comedian Ilana Glazer about immigration and customs enforcement, quote, concentration camps, end quote, Ocasio-Cortez launched into a diatribe about the evils of capitalism, during which she confidently asserted, you can't earn $1 billion. Quote, you just can't earn that, end quote, Ocasio-Cortez went on. Quote, you can get market power, you can break rules, you can do all sorts of things. You can abuse labor laws, you can pay people less than what they are worth, but you can't earn that, end quote. This is false. What market power did Taylor Swift abuse to obtain her billions? What rules did Oprah Winfrey break? What labor laws did Beyonce violate? Who did George Lucas pay less than they were worth? Contrary to Ocasio-Cortez, some people create billions of dollars worth of value for their fellow Americans without breaking any law or abusing any person. It happens all the time. It is not just the entertainment industry. Smartphones, laptops, cars, planes, solar panels, and wind turbines, and every other pillar of modern life have created billionaires. Billionaires have invented products, improved them, manufactured them efficiently, or in one way or another, help millions of people do something they want to do and are willing to pay for. In addition to creating new ways for us to communicate, travel, and power our homes, billionaires have paid hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes along the way, which fund the very social programs that AOC and those of her party most want to expand. The top 1% of income earners pay about 40% of all federal income taxes, despite earning only about 20% of all the income. They are paying their fair share, and arguably more than their fair share. Unfortunately, a growing number of Democrats see billionaires not as engines of economic growth, but as villains who should be punished. Quote, "The enemy is the billionaires," end quote. Graham Platner, the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate in Maine, said in his campaign's introductory video, quote, "The predator class, the billionaires, pose an existential threat to our democracy," end quote. Abdul El-Sayed, the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate in Michigan, said on social media, quote, "Tax them into millionaires," end quote. New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani filmed a video outside billionaire Ken Griffin's private residence while promoting a new tax on the part-time residences of the wealthy. Quote, "This is a fundamentally unfair system," end quote, Mamdani claimed. Quote, "When I ran for mayor, I said I was going to tax the rich. Well, today, we're taxing the rich," end quote. Mamdani is not alone. In California, a ballot proposition leading in the polls would impose a supposedly one-time tax on individuals with more than $1 billion in wealth. In Hawaii, Democrats have proposed a wealth tax on those with a net worth above $20 million. In Minnesota, Democrats are considering a 1% annual tax on wealth above $10 million. And in Washington State, Governor Jay Inslee, Democrat of Washington, has proposed a wealth tax on individuals with a net worth of more than $100 million. You will notice not all of these taxes apply only to billionaires. That is because $1 billion is an arbitrary number. Once Democrats start taxing wealth, they will not stop with billionaires or even the wealthiest 1%. There is no end to Democrats' thirst for other people's money. For now, billionaire job creators can flee to red states from blue states that want to tax them out of existence. The red states are happy to benefit from their drive and creativity. Many upper-income earners have already left California and New York for Texas and Florida. But that only works so long as socialist Democrats do not control the federal government. As soon as they do, they will tax billionaires out of existence, and we will all be poorer for it. You can no longer take that to the bank, but you can take it for granted. What kind of senator was Ben Sasse? By Jay Caruso. When Ben Sasse walked onto the Senate floor in November 2015 to deliver his first speech as a member of the upper chamber, he did something unusual. He had waited a full year to speak. It's part of a Senate tradition known as the maiden speech. A historian by training and a management consulting associate by early vocation, he had spent his first year in the chamber interviewing colleagues, studying how the institution functioned, and developing a diagnosis before offering it publicly. When he finally spoke, the speech landed with enough force that Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, distributed the text to every Republican senator, a gesture the Senate GOP leader at the time, rarely made. Quote, no one in this body thinks the Senate is laser-focused on the most pressing issues facing the nation, end quote, Sassy told his colleagues. Quote, no one, end quote. The indictment was bipartisan, surgical, and delivered with the calm of a man who had considered it carefully before speaking. The Senate, he argued, had surrendered its institutional identity to the rhythms of the 24-hour news cycle, to the demand for sound bites, and to the incentive to grandstand for a narrow base and raise money rather than legislate for a country. Quote, the people despise us all, end quote, he said. Quote, and why is this? Because we are not doing our job, end quote. It served as a warning that went unheeded, and 11 years later, we're watching more dysfunction in government than ever before. Sassy, dying of stage 4 pancreatic cancer at 54, is still saying the same thing. The diagnosis has not changed the message. It has sharpened it. Whether Sassy was a good or effective senator is debatable. Whether Washington currently has enough senators like him is not a close question. The criticism that followed him throughout his 8-year tenure is almost entirely subjective. His critics on the left saw a man willing to deplore Trumpism in public while voting with President Trump's agenda and practice. His critics on the right, particularly as the party realigned, saw a posturing institutionalist more interested in making points and serving as a pundit than in getting on board fully with the president's policies. The most durable version of this critique runs something like, he gave great speeches and passed no significant legislation. Ural Levin, founding editor of National Affairs and director of Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, largely rejects both sets of criticisms. On the Trump question specifically, Levin is direct. Quote, the notion that there was much more he could have done to hold Trump to account is misdirected and mistaken. He took on Trump when he disagreed with him, and when he thought Trump had exceeded his authority or violated his oath. And unlike most Senate Republicans critics of Trump, he ran for re-election and won after doing that, end quote. The objection to the lack of signature legislation mistakes the Senate's function for a body it was never designed to be. In the framework Sassy spent years articulating, the Senate is not primarily a factory for producing legislation. It is a deliberative institution meant to apply friction to democratic impulses in the House of Representatives, to slow things down when people want to move too fast, and to force the executive and judiciary to operate with appropriate constitutional limits. By that standard, which is closer to the founder's intent than the one applied by Sassy's critics, he understood and performed his role better than most of his colleagues. The pundit critique oversimplifies his actual record. Sassy served on the Senate Intelligence Committee throughout his tenure. In his work on China, there was a substantive and largely ahead of the political mainstream. When it was still unfashionable for a Republican to identify Beijing as a generational geopolitical threat rather than an irritating trade partner, Sassy was making that case in the committee rooms that mattered. He had genuine expertise in China's intelligence operations and, accordingly, used his position, spending considerable time in secure facilities at times when most of his colleagues were busy developing more social media strategy. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, who worked alongside him on the intelligence committees, offered perhaps the most precise characterization of what made Sassy different, telling Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes in April that Sassy, quote, never really thought about things as conservative. liberal. He thought much more about issues, such as the future and the past, end quote. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, said Sasse had a, quote, concern not just for today, but for tomorrow and the future, end quote. And that he was, quote, that he, quote, wasn't distracted by all the noise that goes around us on a daily basis, end quote. Sasse's legislative fingerprints are more visible than the pundit label suggests. He helped push through the Protecting American Intellectual Property Act alongside Senator Chris Vann, Democrat from Maryland, mandating sanctions on firms and individuals who steal American trade secrets, and saw it included in the United States Innovation and Competition Act of 2021. He secured an amendment to the legislation authorizing an additional $3.5 billion annually for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, targeting the technology competition with China, and has since become the central organizing principle of American foreign policy. He co-wrote the National Risk Management Act with Senator Maggie Hassan, Democrat from New Hampshire, strengthening Department of Homeland Security oversight of critical infrastructure. He, along with others, introduced the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, a straightforward piece of pro-life legislation that drew little of the attention he received for his more rhetorical comments. Heritage Action, the political arm of the Heritage Foundation, notorious for calling out Republicans in name only, has Sasse's career rating at 85% alignment, above the Senate Republican average of 78%. Levin, who watched Sasse's tenure closely, offers a candid accounting of his legislative limitations. Quote, it's true that Ben was not an active legislator, advancing proposals, sponsoring and co-sponsoring legislation, and building coalitions, end quote, he said. Quote, he was active in some key committees, especially the Intelligence Committee, where it seemed to him that active engagement could make a difference. But I think he concluded this was not the case in some of the other committees, and that he might be more useful as a critic and observer of the institution. No individual senator gets a lot done right now, and of course, that's part of the frustration he had, end quote. But the moments that defined Sasse as a senator were the ones that did not produce legislation. And those are the moments worth examining without the usual condensation. On the first day of Justice Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings in September 2018, the chamber descended almost immediately into the theater that had by then become customary. Protesters disrupted proceedings from the gallery. Democratic senators jockeyed for camera time. The atmosphere was more performance than inquiry. Into this circus, Sasse delivered a 12-minute statement that went viral because it said plainly what almost no one in that room was willing to say. The hysteria around confirmation hearings is a symptom, not the disease. Congress has spent decades delegating its legislative authority to executive agencies and now blame the courts for filling the vacuum. Quote, it is predictable now that every confirmation hearing is going to be an overblown, politicized circus, end quote, he said. Quote, and it's because we've accepted a bad new theory about how our three branches of government should work, end quote. The corrective he offered was simple. Congress should pass laws and stand before voters. The executive should enforce those laws. Judges should apply them, not write them. Naturally, no one disagreed out loud. He delivered a version of the same argument at Justice Amy Coney Barrett's hearing in 2020. Neither speech moved the institution, both captured something true and important about why the institution was failing, and both were widely shared by people who had largely stopped expecting a sitting senator to say anything worth sharing. The Kavanaugh statement was described in this publication at the time as the civics lesson Washington desperately needed, that it needed to be given by a freshman senator to the full Senate Judiciary Committee was Sasse's real point. He also understood, more clearly than most of his colleagues, that the Senate's dysfunction was not incidental, but structural. The cameras, he argued, were a bad incentive. The constant travel and time spent fundraising corroded the relationship that makes effective governing possible. Most tellingly, he believed that senators had come to treat their office as a purpose of their lives rather than a temporary form of service to something larger. When Pelley noted on 60 Minutes that many senators he knew, quote, would not be able to breathe without that job, end quote, Sasse replied that he feared that was true and that it represented, quote, a much, much deeper problem, end quote. The best title a person could hold, he said, was dad, mum, neighbor, friend. Senator was, quote, a great way to serve. It should be your 11th calling or maybe 6th, but never top, quote, end quote. When he resigned from the Senate in January 2023, with 4 years remaining in his term, to become president of the University of Florida, many observers treated it as a confirmation of the pundit critique. He could not stay the course. The more honest reading is that he had concluded the institution was, as he told Pelley, quote, very, very unproductive, end quote, and that there were better things for him to do. Quote, we didn't do real things, end quote, he said. Quote, and it felt like the opportunity cost was really high, end quote. He moved to Florida, then stepped down from his post roughly a year and a half later, when his wife, Melissa, was diagnosed with epilepsy and required full-time care. The man who had argued that being a senator should rank no higher than 6th on a person's list of priorities was living accordingly. Then, on December 23rd, 2025, he posted the news to X. Quote, last week I was diagnosed with metastasized stage 4 pancreatic cancer and am gonna die, end quote. He was 53. Doctors at MD Anderson Cancer Center had cataloged the full spread, lymphoma, vascular cancer, lung cancer, liver cancer, and pancreatic cancer. The point of origin. He had been given 3 to 4 months to live. He called it what it was. Quote, advanced pancreatic is nasty stuff. It's a death sentence, end quote. What followed was unexpected, at least to anyone who had expected Sasse to retreat from public life. He launched a podcast called Not Dead Yet. He sat down for a conversation with the New York Times columnist Ross Douthat on the latter's Interesting Times podcast in April, which was released just days after the interview aired and subsequently circulated widely. He appeared on 60 Minutes with Pelley on April 26th, his face visibly marked by his medication, a drug called Garaxonoracib from Revolution Medicines that had shrunk his tumors by 76% and extended his life by months that were not supposed to exist. He credited the extra time to, quote, providence, prayer, and a miracle drug, end quote. The Douthat interview was the more intimate of the two conversations and the more remarkable. Douthat asked Sasse at the close whether he felt ready to die. Sasse said he did not feel ready, but that he had hope, grounded in his reformed Christian faith, that he would be with God. The response moved Althad visibly to tears, something Sassy responded to with his characteristic dry humor. Earlier in the conversation, Sassy reflected on what the disease had given him alongside what it had taken. Quote, "I hate pancreatic cancer," end quote, he told Althad. Quote, "I would never wish it on anyone, but I would never want to go back to a time in my life where I didn't know the prayer of pancreatic cancer. I can't keep the planets in orbit. I can't even grow skin on my face," end quote. The, quote, "prayer of pancreatic cancer," end quote, as Sassy uses this phrase, is something like the acknowledgement of dependence that most people spend their healthiest years avoiding. He is not unusual among the terminally ill in arriving at that acknowledgement. He is unusual in the way that he has extended it outward, into public argument, into some institutional critique he was making in November 2015. On 60 Minutes, he was asked what Congress was missing, and he named the artificial intelligence revolution, the future of work, and the complete absence of 2030 or 2050 thinking in either party. Then, without prompting, he returned to the frame he had always used. Quote, "The Senate needs to be less like Instagram. The Senate needs to be more deliberative, and that means less smackdown nonsense," end quote, he told Pelley, adding, quote, "The Senate should be plodding and steady and boring and trustworthy," end quote. He had been saying some version of that sentence for more than a decade. Sassy leaves no signature legislation bearing his name on the front. What he leaves is rarer in the current political environment, a coherent argument about what the Senate is supposed to be, made consistently, publicly, and at real political cost by a man who spent 8 years in the institution and found it resistant to everything he believed about it. That he could not reform the Senate is not surprising. That he kept trying right up until his diagnosis and through it is a thing worth noting. Levin is cautiously hopeful about whether that effort was entirely in vain. Quote, "The renewal of the Senate will follow from the frustration of senators who want it to be more relevant and functional," end quote, he said. Quote, "The sentiment is certainly growing, but it will need to be reasonably durable and bipartisan to matter, and we're not there yet. I do think we could find ourselves there, absolutely, but it will take more people like Ben Sassy willing to run and to embody that view," end quote. The senators who followed him mostly did not replace him. The Senate he described, plodding and steady and boring and trustworthy, is further from realization now than when he walked onto that floor in November 2015 and told his colleagues the truth. That is not a failure, but a confirmation. The Colbert Collapse by Daniel Ross Goodman. On May 21st, Stephen Colbert will host his final episode of The Late Show on CBS, bringing down the curtain not only on his 11-year run, but on the entire Late Show franchise, a CBS institution since David Letterman launched it in 1993. The finale will feature an all-star parade: Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers, John Oliver, Letterman himself, Tom Hanks, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Pedro Pascal, and The Strokes. Kimmel, in a nod to their friendship, will air a rerun rather than compete. The send-off will be suitably grand. But here is the uncomfortable truth that no amount of celebrity cameos can paper over. The show ending is not quite the one many of us, who were devoted fans of Colbert in his Comedy Central heyday, had hoped it would become. When Colbert took over from Letterman in 2015, I was genuinely excited. I had written in Public Disclosure in January 2015 about the genius of his 9-year Colbert Report, how it ranked among the most brilliant and daring achievements in the history of American television comedy. My expectations for what he might do with CBS's largest platform were enormous. My disappointment over the decade that followed was commensurate. The Late Show is ending in circumstances that are murky, contested, and deeply revealing about where political comedy and broader landscape of American discourse stands in the age of Trump. To understand the disappointment of the CBS show, you must first understand how extraordinary the Comedy Central show was. The Colbert Report, which ran from 2005 to 2014, was built on one of the most audacious conceits in television history. Colbert played a pompous, self-aggrandizing cable news pundit, transparently modeled on the Bill O'Reilly school of blowhard bravado, with such conviction and deadpan command that millions tuned in nightly to watch what amounted to a one-man theatrical performance. As I wrote a decade ago, it was like watching a Tony Award-winning actor reprise his role for a 9-year Broadway run, except where the theater actors are at least able to recite the same lines show after show. Colbert was working from a brand new script every night. His appearances beyond the studio, testifying before Congress in character in 2010, roasting President George W. Bush at the 2006 White House Correspondents' Association dinner, were the acts of genuine artistic and civic courage. The report was, at its best, not just funny. It was revelatory. And then came CBS. On Comedy Central, Colbert was a must-watch. You never quite knew what he was going to do, because the character he had built was expansive and strange enough to go anywhere and say anything. On CBS, you always knew exactly what he was going to say. The monologue would skewer President Donald Trump. The desk piece would skewer Trump. The guest interview would pivot at some point to Trump. The format was not revelatory. It was reactive. When you strip away the character, you strip away the distance. Satire requires a certain remove from its target. The Colbert of Comedy Central had that remove built into its form. The Colbert of CBS was, increasingly, just a smart and angry man behind a desk, preaching to a choir that already knew every hymn. Variety, reviewing the final season, called the show not very good TV and out of touch with everyday Americans. That verdict, however, harsh, is not wrong. CBS announced in July 2025 that it would end the Late Show franchise entirely in May 2026, calling it purely a financial decision against a challenging backdrop in late night. And stressing it was not related in any way to the show's performance, content, or other matters happening at Paramount. The cancellation came just 3 days after Colbert went on air to call Paramount's $16 million settlement to Donald Trump's lawsuit over the editing of a 60 Minutes interview a big, fat bribe. Paramount was awaiting Federal Communications Commission approval for its merger with Skydance Media, which required the blessing of a Trump-appointed regulatory apparatus. Quote, "I absolutely love that Colbert got fired," end quote, a celebratory Trump posted on Truth Social. Quote, "His talent was even less than his ratings," end quote. Colbert himself, in a diplomatically ambiguous New York Times interview, said he believed, quote, "two things can be true," end quote, that the economics of broadcast late night had generally become unsustainable, and that something more ominous may also be been at work. Quote, "less than 2 years before, they called to say it's over," end quote, he said. Quote, "they were very eager for me to be signed for a long time, so something changed," end quote. The economics are real. Late Show viewership had declined from a peak of over 3 million 6 years ago to roughly $2.4 million by mid-2025. And ad revenue dropped about 25% from 2022 to 2024. CBS's replacement for the franchise is Byron Allen's Comics Unleashed, a roundtable comedy program deliberately designed to avoid political humor. The TV programming equivalent of stuffing yourself with plain white bread and chugging a quart of milk after you've mistakenly eaten a jalapeno pepper because your mouth is on fire and you're desperate to avoid anything that might renew the sensation that had been causing your tongue to burn. If Colbert's cancellation was the most dramatic front in the war between the Trump administration and late-night television, it is hardly the only one. In a story I covered in these same pages in September 2025, ABC briefly suspended Jimmy Kimmel Live after Kimmel made comments about the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr threatened punitive regulatory action, including potential revocation of broadcast licenses, if Kimmel was not reprimanded. Broadcast station owners Nexstar and Sinclair pulled the show from their ABC affiliates. ABC eventually brought Kimmel back, whereupon he addressed the controversy on air, but explicitly, quote, made no apologies, end quote, for his ill-fated joke. The confrontation has since escalated. In a parody routine last month, Kimmel, riffing on the upcoming White House Correspondents Association dinner, quipped that Melania Trump had, quote, the glow of an expectant widow, end quote, a joke about the age gap between the First Lady and the President. Even attempting to explain the joke still can't cover up its awful taste and even poorer judgment. Days later, the dinner itself was cut short when an armed man attempted to enter the Washington ballroom. Both Trump and Melania then called on Disney and ABC to fire Kimmel immediately, with Melania calling his words, quote, hateful and violent rhetoric, end quote. And Trump declaring the joke, quote, something far beyond the pale, end quote. Kimmel responded in his monologue that it was, quote, not by any stretch of the definition a call to assassination, end quote. Reports emerged of an FCC review of Disney's broadcast licenses. This is the context worth remembering. In December 2024, ABC had already paid $15 million towards Trump's future presidential library to settle a defamation lawsuit over remarks by anchor George Stephanopoulos. The patent is difficult to ignore. Late-night television is currently in the intensive care unit of the TV world, and it's doubtful whether it'll make it out alive. Oliver's HBO deal concluded in 2026. Kimmel has hinted at retirement. Fallon and Myers remain at NBC through 2028, but their shows have absorbed significant budget cuts. Myers lost his house band, and Fallon has cut to 4 tapings a week. Jon Stewart's Daily Show contract has been renewed for another season, but unlike Fallon and Kimmel and Colbert, Stewart is only on the air once a week, and it's unclear how much longer he'll want to continue after 2026. After Stewart goes, The Daily Show could very well go with him. Letterman himself recently said that he, quote, would be surprised, end quote, if late-night television, quote, lasts more than a year, end quote, in its current form. The economics of streaming have gutted the advertising model that once sustained these productions, and that is a real part of the story. But economics alone cannot explain why a president publicly celebrates the cancellation of a program that criticized him, or why a regulatory agency threatens broadcast licenses over a comedian's monologue. There is something more than market forces at work here. What is at stake is the role comedy has historically played in American public discourse. A role going back to Mark Twain and finding its late 20th century expression in Johnny Carson, Letterman, and then, most brilliantly, in the Stewart-Colbert axis of the early 2000s. Political comedy is not merely entertainment. At its best, it is a form of critique that reaches audiences pure journalism cannot, saying things straight that reportage cannot say because it operates under the cover of the joke. When the space is constricted by regulatory threat, by corporate timidity, by audiences migrating to fragmented podcasts and streaming alternatives, something real is lost. Podcast hosts and YouTube commentators have picked up parts of the mantle, but their reach is different in kind, not just in scale. The nightly late night broadcast addressing a genuinely mass national audience performed a specific and irreplaceable function in the Democratic conversation. None of this diminishes what Colbert achieved. The Late Show won a Peabody and its first Emmy for Outstanding Variety Talk Series in 2025, the final season of its existence. Colbert was number one in his time slot for 9 straight seasons, and yet the CBS show, for all its accolades, never recaptured the electric, slightly dangerous quality that made the Colbert Report essential. It settled into a groove of anti-Trump leftism, perfectly calibrated for its base, but really surprising. The Colbert of Comedy Central encompassed the entire panorama of American political and cultural absurdity. The Colbert of CBS became increasingly a spokesman for one side of a binary argument. The difference is not trivial. It is the difference between art and advocacy, between a show that illuminated something true about the human condition and one that confirmed what its audience already believed. In his New York Times interview, Colbert was characteristically gracious about the end. Quote, 11 years is a long time to work here, and almost 10 years before that, almost 21 years altogether in late night. I feel so much better to be grateful for than to be mad about, end quote. The equanimity reads less like complacency than the considered perspective of a man who understands better than anyone that the best work of his career happened at an earlier hour, on a smaller network, under a stranger set of constraints. When I wrote about the end of the Colbert Report in 2015, I asked whether Colbert would be remembered as one of the greatest television characters of all time, alongside Cosmo Kramer and George Costanza. I answered yes. I still stand by that judgment. The character he built on Comedy Central was one of the most brilliant and durable satirical creations in the history of the medium. The man who had inhabited his remains one of the most gifted performers of his generation. But the CBS version of Stephen Colbert, the real man, without the character's protective armor of irony, never quite found a form equal to his gifts. On May 21st, the lights will go down at the Ed Sullivan Theater for the last time. As a late-night venue, Letterman will be there, though the franchise he built will not be passed to anyone. It will simply cease, replaced by Comics Unleashed, a program whose apolitical guiding philosophy is the inverse of everything Colbert represented. Colbert, in his final New York Times interview, said, "I don't have any problems with Trump being a Republican. I have a problem with Trump being a complete narcissist who is only working for his own interest and does not appear to care if the entire world burns." Regardless of whether or not this is true, and regardless of whether or not you agree with Colbert, it is honest insofar as it is perfectly reflective of what he believes. And it's precisely this honesty that reveals the ocean-wide chasm between the enervated earnestness of his CBS show and the comic genius of his Comedy Central work. On the Colbert Report, Colbert would not have said this. He would have found a way to make it funnier and stranger and more devastating. That is the measure of what was lost when the character went away. When Colbert ended the Colbert Report in December 2014, he staged a mock resurrection, defeating death and ascending into heaven in a sleigh driven by Santa Claus, carrying Abraham Lincoln, Captain America, and Alex Trebek, leading a chorus of "We'll Meet Again." It was a finale worthy of the show, biblical, mythological, and absurd all at once. On May 21st, the Late Show credits roll for the last time. There will be no such mythology on offer, only the allegiac fact of a disappointing show ending, and behind it, the frustrating image of the great one that might have been.